Thank you for joining us at 9 a.m. for our first panel. My name is Ann Bradley, and I'm the George and Sally Mayer Fellow for Economic Education and the Academic Director at the Fund for American Studies, and I'm going to be your moderator this morning. And so our topic today is the future of economic freedom in an age of trillion-dollar companies, which is so relevant if you're just scrolling through any of your news feeds. And so that's kind of how we're going to focus our conversation and dialogue today. I'm going to start by introducing both of our speakers separately, and then I'm just going to give a few minutes of overview of kind of how we're going to think about this big topic today. And then I'm going to sit down. Each speaker is going to have 10 minutes to give some insights, some of their own insights, and then I'll moderate Q&A both with the speakers, and then we'll open it up to the audience. So first, I would like to introduce Dr. Luigi Zingales is the Robert C. McCormick Distinguished Service Professor of Entrepreneurship and Finance at the Charles M. Harper Faculty Fellow at the University of Chicago Booth School of Business. In 2014, he was president of the American Finance Association. In July 2015, he became the director of the Stigler Center at the University of Chicago. His research interests span from corporate governance to financial development, from political economy to the economic effects of culture. He has published extensively in the major economics and financial journals. He also wrote two best-selling books, Saving Capitalism from the Capitalists and A Capitalism for the People. In January 2018, he launched a new podcast, Capitalizant, with Catherine Waldock from Georgetown University. Zingales received a bachelor's degree in economics from Università Bocconi in Italy and a PhD in economics from MIT. So that's Dr. Zingales. And then I want to introduce also Dr. Brian Domitrovic, Associate Professor of Education at Sam Houston State University. He has a PhD in history from Harvard University and an MA also from Harvard. His research interests include modern intellectual and economic history and where those two intersect. He looks at the oscillations of the 20th century, intense bouts of disorder and mayhem that often stand side by side or give way to incredible stretches of mass prosperity. He has published four books, including Econoclasts, A History of Supply-Side Economics, The Pillars of Reaganomics, a collection of the work of economist Arthur Laffer, JFK and the Reagan Revolution, and Laffer Associates, Oil and Energy, 35 Years of Supply-Side Insights. So will you join me quickly in welcoming our panelists? Thank you. As an economist, I'm really interested in the topics of economic freedom and how our world has changed and the issues that we have to wrestle with in kind of the modern age of prosperity. So when I was thinking about how I wanted to frame this, I thought back to 1859 when Charles Dickens published the historical novel A Tale of Two Cities about the years leading up to the French Revolution, and he opens with these lines: "It was the best of times, it was the worst of times. It was the age of wisdom. It was the age of foolishness. It was the epoch of belief. It was the epoch of incredulity. It was the season of light. It was the season of darkness. It was the spring of hope. It was the winter of despair." It is language of paradox, reflecting a time in human history when, for those who were living in it, the world would change in ways that they could not have ever predicted. It brought with it the biggest sustained increases in human prosperity ever known. Imagine living on the cusp of that. Prior to 1750, there had been no long-term sustained economic growth. The living standards for ordinary people were equally poor. In 1859, when Dickens was writing, the average life expectancy in Western Europe and the U.S. was 42 years old. 40% of children born didn't make it past their fifth birthday. World incomes were largely at subsistence levels, but the West was growing and getting richer. The Industrial Revolution was upon us. A little over 100 years later, economists decided we needed to empirically measure the conditions that gave rise to such prosperity. The economist who did this and was one of the leaders was Milton Friedman. Others have joined him and followed him. He and others came up with what we now know and refer to as the Economic Freedom Project, which helps us understand the environmental conditions in which prosperity is either allowed to bloom or is stunted. In the context of today's session, we want to think about how in only 150 years since Dickens was writing, not only have we all become fantastically richer, but we are now living in an age of trillion-dollar companies. Global inequality is declining, yet trillion-dollar companies like Amazon, which are really possible only in the conditions of economic freedom, give rise to fears about power and control. How will economic freedom, which has brought so much prosperity to so many ordinary people, and that's, after all, who we care about, fare in the age of companies like Amazon, Apple, Google, and Microsoft? Can private economic wealth be distinct from political power? These will be some of our topics for today. So we want to directly connect the Economic Freedom of the World report, which has consistently measured the status of these conditions, sound money, limited government, the rule of law, levels of regulation, to companies who are able to be this large. And Friedman's project allows us to kind of empirically look at that. So right now, I'm going to sit down and join our panelists, and we're going to start with our first question, which I'll just say while I'm still up here at the mic. So this is for both of you. How do we know if and when a firm is too big? Do large firms bring unique threats to free markets and democratic institutions? I'll let whoever wants to start, start.
So first of all, thank you very much for inviting me here. It's very exciting to be in front of such a distinguished audience. Let me try to answer the first question, which is, how do we measure what is big and what is too big? And actually, if we go by traditional measure of sales or employees, these companies are not, today's companies are not particularly large. In 1970, the largest companies in the world was General Motors. And General Motors had basically, if you divide the sales at a time by GDP, is roughly what is today Walmart, which is the largest company in the world by sales and certainly by employees. However, if we look at stock market capitalization, and that's what Anne was mentioning, it is clearly we are in a special period. If you look at the record largest companies in U.S. history, the first one was broke by U.S. Steel the day it went public in 1901 at $1 billion, which divided by the then GDP of the United States was roughly 5% of U.S. GDP. Now, that record not only was not broken, but would not even come close for many, many years. In 1987, just before the stock market crash, IBM flirted with the $100 billion benchmark. Did not actually break it, flirted. And even that would have been only 2% of GDP. It takes actually 2018 with Apple reaching the $1 trillion mark, and that is roughly 5% of GDP. Now, since Apple has dropped a bit, so it's below that benchmark, but what is interesting is there are four companies that are in the $750 billion range, which makes them extremely large by historical standard. So the question is, number one, why? And number two, should we worried about? So I think that the first answer is the easiest one, and it's why is because they are extremely profitable. So what is unique of this period, as was unique of the 1901, is not so much the sheer size of these companies, is how profitable they are. And this is not linked to just one or two companies. What is remarkable, if you look at the U.S. stock markets in the last 30 or 40 years, is the decline of companies that make any profit. If you look at the stock market today, 60% of the small companies and 30% of the large companies have negative earnings per share. You say, wait a minute, we hear about profit share increasing and all this stuff. How is that possible? And the answer is very simple, because there are few companies that make a ton of profits. So the concentration of profits at the top has increased dramatically. and has increased at every level. And it says, I'm sure you all have heard about the phenomenon of superstar firms. Superstar firms are the firms that are very profitable, and many of the other firms don't make any money. So this idea of concentration of profits is something that is to some extent novel, and is something that at the very minimum we should be concerned about. Now, not necessarily, and then I come back to that, but I think I want to emphasize that is something we should pay attention. But that would not be the only problem if it wasn't added by two other factors. Factor number two is the concentration of political power. I'm sure you're all aware that in 1971, Powell wrote a memorandum, the famous sort of Powell memo, say that we are basically taken over intellectually by socialism, and that we need to fight back as business in order to reconquer the upper hand in this ideological battle. And it was true. I think that the early 1970s was a time of extremely powerful influence of people like Ralph Nader, the consumer movement, regulation. And honestly, the term business was kind of almost like a four-letter word. And if you do Google Engram and you look at the term pro-business, you see that in the 60s and 70s, the term was used very little. And the Power Memorandum was extremely influential. And actually, if you have the Google Engram, you see that the word pro-business start to go up tremendously after 1970. And so did the amount of lobbying that firms did. In 1970, most firms did not even have a government department, did not certainly have a lobbyist in Washington. Microsoft, until the antitrust suit, did not have a lobbyist in Washington. Today, firms have a lobbyist even before they start. I remember that during the financial crisis, a young entrepreneur approached me, and with that idea, that was actually not a bad idea. So I started talking to him, and then I said, why you came to me? Because he was not my student, and I'm not the most famous entrepreneurial professor in the country, so why did he come to me? And the answer was pretty disheartening. He said, oh, because I see you're very vocal, and I need a champion in the intellectual arena. I need a champion in Washington. Why? In order to try to get some of the subsidies of the TAP program for small firms. At which point I stopped being engaged with him. But the interesting thing is that before even you have a fully formed business plan, you have a lobbying plan. Okay? And the amount of this is unprecedented. So when Obama got elected president, 251 individuals moved from Google to the White House. When the Federal Trade Commission had a hearing about privacy, 23 of the 41 speakers were somehow paid by Google. The number of employees of Google that visited the Obama White House between the inauguration to the summer of 2015, 427 times. 21 of which were intimate meetings with President Obama. And actually, there is two researchers at the University of Illinois who study, thanks to actually the disclosure of the Obama White House that allowed to see who was going in and out of the White House, what happens to the stock price when an executive visits the White House. And surprise, surprise, the stock price goes up. Okay? And I don't think it's because they are enlightened by speaking with the president. It's because they get some special favor. Okay? So I think that the problem is not just that there are phenomenally profitable companies and this is highly concentrated, is that these companies are also phenomenally connected with the president. Now, if you add to these two things, the third aspect, which is never in the history of humanity, so few people control so much data. The amount of information that the four giants all about us is staggering. I'm not a tech, and I recently learned that if you go into your Apple, they see every place you have been in the last 6 months. So Apple today knows that I'm here. Google today knows that I'm here because I Google to come here. Uber knows that I'm here because I Uber here. And probably some other few app I don't even know that I'm here. Okay? And I think the amount of control that we can have is amazing. So we are terrified, and rightly so, by the introduction in China of the social score. But we're not that far off. Now, I'm happily married and too old to date, but younger people who are on the dating market tells me that, first of all, today you date with an app. For the first time in history, the first way to get a date is not through friends and family and connection, is online. But second, at the first date, the first question is, what is your Uber score? Why? Because they want to see whether you are a jerk or not. And so we are at the level of, and of course, this is voluntarily disclosed, but Uber and all this thing know perfectly well how jerks we are and so on and so forth. So the concentration of this should be worried in the sense, clearly, if you are in China, that is very, very worrisome because you have one government, and accurately a non-democratic and non-benign government that controls all this information. The Big Brothers is alive and well and is present. But should be worried in a country like the United States, given that these companies are in private hands, and they're not just one, they are multiple, and so there is some degree of competition. And the answer is, of course, if we compare ourselves to China, we are in great shape. I'm not so sure that that's the benchmark we want to benchmark against. And I think that there are two reasons to be worried. The first one is a very sheer economic reasons. We believe in capitalism because capitalists produce the greatest amount of wealth for the greatest amount of people. But the benefit of capitalist work through competition where everybody is treated the same. In a world in which some companies have special access and most of the others don't, this is not a world of fair and equal competition. And what I describe in the paper is what I call the Medici vicious circle, because the Medici family, that was a very prominent family in Florence in the 15th century, actually gained power through banking. But unlike other Florentine families that gained power through banking and then they lost it through banking because of new entry, they moved from banking to the political business. And then they stay in power for 300 years. So once you, money gives you power, and power gives you money. And this is a very dangerous circle that companies are going down very much in the United States today. And chronic capitalism is alive and well in this country. But even if you don't care about economics, and I don't know, we see why you shouldn't, but you care only about freedom, I think that we should be very concerned about this enormous concentration of power. So I don't like Bolsonaro, but when Bolsonaro was running his campaign, at some point, Facebook decided unilaterally to stop the advertising on WhatsApp, because Facebook owns WhatsApp and owns Instagram. And why? Just because they didn't like Bolsonaro. Now, we know very well that the ranking of Google affects, the ranking of the search affects our consumption choices. And there is some research that say potentially affects your voting choices. Now, I'm not here to say that Google has used this, but are we sure they will never do that? And probably not for a U.S. presidential election. Why? Because you're too visible. But when you go down to a congressional election, and when you go to a congressional election in India, are we sure that if I am campaigning on taxing Google, I'm not put last in every search on the face of Earth if I'm in India? I think that that threat is a very important threat that we need to be aware of. Last but not least, even if this is in private hands, how do we make sure that the government is not going to do a Faustian pact between the governing power and the power of these companies? Once you have an extreme concentration of power, the government needs to reach a compromise, and the company is very happy to compromise with the government. That is the reason why many developing countries is difficult to have a private, for example, oil industry. Because in Mexico, at least historically, either the government owned oil or the oil industry owned the government. There is nothing in between. Why? Because there is too much concentration of power. And so it's too easy, if you are extremely powerful, to reach an agreement with the president. And of course, you don't reach in public, you reach in private, and that's very distorted. So, given all this concern, what can we do about it? So, first of all, let me put a plug here. As a Stiegler Center, we're organizing this May, the 15th and 16th of May, a conference on the digital platforms where we try to look at what is different today with respect to history about these platforms, what are the potential problems, and what are the potential solutions. We're not going to propose anything specifically. We want to say an array of proposals. But what is unique about this conference is we're trying to tackle the problem for four points of view. Because most of the people look at this either only from an economic point of view or only from a privacy point of view. What we're going to do is look from economic privacy, but also media, because these are the biggest media company in the world, and political economy, because they have so much influence in our political system that it's hard to stop. And I want to leave you, because I have to stop, I want to leave you with a statement that will surprise you. Many of you know the Chicago School with Friedman and Stiegler and others, and Dick Posner. Now, this is to some extent the modern Chicago School. All these guys were students of Henry Simons in the 30s and 40s. And Henry Simons was an advocate about intervention to preserve free markets and competition. He wrote a little pamphlet in the 30s called A Positive Program for Laissez-Faire, which seems like a contradiction in terms, but actually is important. And George Stiegler, in his early days, wrote a piece I strongly recommended you to read. In 1952, in Fortune, he writes a piece called The Trouble with Big Business. And in this piece, he says something that might seem strange. He says, breaking up big business is not only the right program, it's also the conservative program. And say, what is conservative about breaking up big business? He said, oh, wait a second. Because the alternative might be much worse. The alternative is regulation that intermingle in everything you do. So it's better to break big business and let it compete rather than interfere every second. So I'm not saying that we should all break up everything, but I say that we should rediscover the root of the Chicago tradition. And the root of the Chicago tradition is when big business is extremely powerful, you need to sort of tame it, because concentration of power is dangerous. And let me finish with power corrupts, and absolute power corrupts absolutely. Whether this is political or economic power is still the same problem. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Anne, for introducing me. Thank you to the Philly Sock for having me. Anne, I was inspired to hear your words from Charles Dickens in his opening line of From a Tale of Two Cities. I was reminded of the opening line of Howard Stern's memoir, "It was the worst of times, it was the worst of times." I think we're doing a little better than that. I don't think we should be so fearful of the brand new big companies in this country. Before I forget it, I had to write it down. If I might just make a few observations on some of Luigi's remarks. In 1901, when United States Steel first went public with J.P. Morgan, there was no savings scramble. There was no savings crisis in the United States because the dollar was defined in gold. People didn't have to worry about managing portfolios. The little guy didn't. But today, everybody has to buy stocks so that they can keep their money solid against inflation and taxes. So the market capitalization of, in total is much higher relative to GDP today than it was then. And also, when IBM became almost $100 billion company in the late 80s, the question that the new CEO would soon ask was, who says elephants can't dance? And we know what the answer was. The market said that elephants can't dance. So that problem was completely avoided by the company's own incompetence. IBM has become essentially a government contractor today, and that was through its natural processes of its inability to manage its largeness. So I think those kinds of processes are built in, and that solutions rapidly come organically of their own accord. So I just have 3 points to make about big companies. I'd like to start with George Stigler's 1950s. As Larry Kudlow and I wrote about in JFK and the Reagan Revolution, some of the biggest opponents to the big tax rate cuts that were being proposed in the 1950s that then John F. Kennedy adopted in the 1960s were the Fortune 500. The Fortune 500 began as such in 1955. That's when Fortune magazine, 3 years after Stigler's article, introduced that concept. And Ford Motor in particular was a big opponent of tax rate cuts, and their congressional testimony in 1963 made that very clear. Their rationale. The rationale is if there are tax rate cuts, then we'll lose our best talent, and our best talent will start firms, and they'll compete against us. The marginal rate of the income tax was 91%, the capital gains rate was 25%, and there were clever ways for corporations, big corporations, that had very special statutes written into the law care of lobbyists, and there was a huge lobbyist crisis in the 50s. I mean, political science was full of all this kind of hand-wringing in the 50s about how many lobbyists there are in Washington. And if you were a large corporation, you could make sure that your executives were paid at the capital gains rate instead of the marginal rate of the income tax. They said if you lower that marginal rate of the income tax, there's going to be an exit of the best talent from these firms. So needless to say, John F. Kennedy cut taxes, and people like Robert Noyce leave Fairchild Semiconductor and form Intel. And that is exactly what happened in the 1980s to the 2000s. There was about an 80% turnover from 1980 to 2000 in the composition of the Fortune 500. So when government retreats, particularly in the era of area of taxation, but also, I should say, regulation, the ability of large firms that exist because of cronyism and because of their tight relationships in Washington is severely abrogated and attenuated, and the natural processes of the market self-correct the whole situation. If we had a discussion in 1980, and maybe we do in the Philly Sock archives we can listen to online, about the problem of all the big firms in 1980, Bethlehem Steel, which bestrode the nation in that year, we would find that in no time flat, they were replaced by Federal Express and Apple and Coca-Cola and all the rest. The third point I have is the question that Jeremy Bentham and, of course, Vladimir Lenin asked, whom? Who is doing what to whom? Government is going to regulate business? Well, the first question I have is about that first term, government. Now, some people say that this is impolite. It's been a long tradition that it's impolite to say that the worst performers in the workforce are those who work for government, that there's a kind of natural selection process in the workforce such that those who are naturally ambitious and know what's going on work in the private sector, and those that are remainders work for the government. Not to press the point, but if that has any grain of truth, and it was taken as an absolute verity in the American polity in the 19th century when the main government employees were post office workers and customs collectors, it was an absolute verity that the dregs of the workforce work for the government. If we can just entertain that as an idea, who is to do this regulation? Well, by definition, the worst elements of the workforce. Therefore, necessarily, they will get it wrong. The companies we're talking about right now, the FANG companies, for example, are neologisms of the 21st century, a century that's 19 years old at this point. That's a blink of an eye in economics terms. I should also point out that there is one new poster child of a very regulated firm, very large regulated firm, that has become one of the most hated firms in its region, if not the country, and that's Pacific Gas and Electric in California, which is really an exemplar of a government-regulated firm. I think it's much too early in this 19-year cycle of the 21st century to say that these firms are getting too large. I think we just had our corporate tax cut a year and a half ago, down to 21%. We say these companies make a lot of money. Well, they don't declare a lot of profits. I mean, Amazon, it's a big company, only declares $11 billion a year. That's not so much for the biggest thing in the world. And I think if you see lower and lower corporate tax rates, you'll see fewer and fewer, less and less ability of these large firms to game the high tax rate. The most significant aspect, the most significant reason we have high marginal tax rates is that they confer value on exemptions. That has always been the most significant role of the marginal tax rate. The marginal tax rate has rarely correlated to revenue. And so if you lower and lower that tax rate, those exceptions to the tax rate become necessarily devalued, and that damages the biggest companies the most. So the most effective way, it would appear to me, if you want to kind of scramble the game plan of the biggest companies, is to continue to lower tax rates. I'd take the corporate tax rate and the capital gains rate to zero. Thank you very much.
Thank you both so much. So I want to start with a question that kind of brings together, I think, points that both of you raised, which is we talk about this word, especially kind of more and more today, but in economics in particular, this idea of cronyism. Could you each talk a little bit about how you define cronyism? And what threat uniquely does it pose to kind of the foundations of economic freedom as we understand them?
Happy to start. I think cronyism is simply a system where the rules of the games are defined by the most powerful players and not are defined to maximize the sort of value added of the game. I always use this example, as you will understand in a second. My son is a bit angry that I use this example. But when my son and my daughter were small, they were playing Monopoly. And at the time, my son could read. My daughter was a couple of years younger, could not perfectly read. And all the time that they were starting playing Monopoly, we'll end up with my daughter crying. So I would intervene and say, "Why are you crying?" And she will accuse my son of cheating. And my son, with the rules of Monopoly, and they say, no, I follow the rule. Now, my understanding is there was selection in his recollection of the rules. He was the only one who could sort of read, so he will only remember the rules in his favor and not the rules in other favor. And my daughter, who is no fool, she couldn't understand what was going on exactly, but she understood enough to complain. Why I use this example? Because I think it's a very useful metaphor of what happened. And it says, first of all, if you play Monopoly and somebody can change the rules or remembers only the rules that are in his favor, clearly the game is no fun. It's not sort of maximizing the potential of the game. But also, you create enormous sense of frustration that even if it's not well articulated, because my daughter at the time could not well articulate, leads to revolt, the crime. And that's a metaphor of what happens today in the system. So when you have some people that alter the rule of the game to the advantage of themselves, you have two negative effects. Number one, you have an unfair system that distributes things in an incorrect way and actually underproduces with respect to its potential. That's the US economy today. Number two, you have a lot of people who are dissatisfied with the system. And they are not sophisticated enough to say, we are dissatisfied because somebody is cheating, but we want to keep the game. They don't want to play the game anymore.
Yeah, cronyism. I always get a little bit confused with that false friend, old crone, which I think just means an elderly woman, I think. I know F. Scott Fitzgerald uses the term old crone all the time, but that's not what cronyism means, no. I think cronyism, I think the metaphor that hits home to me with cronyism is all the building in Washington, D.C., all the cranes and the tremendous number of edifices that have arisen in Washington, specifically over the last 10 or 20 years. If you have high tax rates, if you have a significant regulatory apparatus, if you have spending, and if you have non-defined money, all of those are dinner bells for people to come and ask for the government to set the table in their fashion, if I may mix all those metaphors. So I think if you pursue Arthur Laffer's five pillars of Reaganomics, if you pursue low tax rates, deregulation, free trade, spending restraint, and sound money, all of a sudden the opportunity for cronyism decreases across the board because there's nothing to get from the government. Do you want an exception from a 5% tax rate? That's not really worth anything. I mean, an exception from a 35% tax rate is worth something. As I've said, I mean, empirically, this is actually quite so, especially in the marginal rate of the income tax. It has essentially no relevance in terms of the revenue prospects of the federal government. Its entire value attaches to the exemptions that come from it via cronyism. So cronyism is simply playing ball with the existence of government policy.
I think that people on the left and the right certainly agree with that. In recent days, we've heard Elizabeth Warren, in fact, come out, right, and say that this is a problem and that the government needs to take an active role in figuring out how to dismantle some of these larger corporations. So is this an appropriate response with respect to preserving those pillars of economic freedom, preserving an environment of exit and entry into markets, market competition, guided by profit and loss? So what do each of you think about that?
I think that it's hard to have one size fits it all. In a sense, I think that he's absolutely right that expansion of government powers lead to more cronies. But I don't think that in the jungle things work so well. Think about a government, a business where the government is not involved, or at least try to be involved but is out, which is the mafia business, the criminal business. There is no sort of government there. However, I don't think it's the model of business we want to have. And why? And this is because there are no rules except basically the rule of the strongest, and this leads to enormous concentration, enormous violence, but actually in a stable equilibrium, not even a lot of violence, it's just a threat of violence, but an enormous amount of concentration, and that is problematic. So I think that we need to think in very different ways. So should we be more careful about the amount of procurement of the government because it leads to more cronyism, et cetera? Absolutely. But are we sure that in a world of intangible capital with large digital platforms, there is not a tendency to a concentration? And by the way, some of this concentration takes place through a manipulation of the legal system. So one of the things that makes Facebook so powerful is that it's hard to switch from one social network to the other. Because you want to be where your friends are. Now, in economic terms, that's called multi-homing. Now, you might think that this multi-homing is technically impossible, and the answer is absolutely not. It's impossible legally. Why? Because there was a little venture called actually Power Ventures that was helping you manage all your social networks. So you could give to this venture your passwords, log in Facebook, log in in MySpace, log in a lot of different social, and you will transfer all your data information across those. That will favor competition. You know what happened to Power Venture? Went out of business because was sued by Facebook. And Facebook was able to establish that if I give to Anne my login and password for Facebook voluntarily and she gets in, she commits a federal crime. I granted you, but it's called hacking, and it stopped. Why did it stop? Because they want to prohibit multi-homing, because that increases the market power. So this is nothing to do with government regulation. It's an example of how companies create their own rules in order to entrench themselves. That's where we need to come in and create rules for competition. I think that portability of the social graph is a useful instrument for competition, like is portability of your cell phone number. Those of you who are a little bit older remember a time where you did not own your phone number, okay? Why did that? Now you can own it? This ironically was government regulation that introduced the portability, and that increases competition and brought down the cost of cell phones. So sometimes the government needs to intervene to increase competition, and certainly in the digital platform business, that's one area.
Yeah, let me second Luigi's point that it's certainly conceivable that right now the legal or regulatory apparatus could be captured in the George Stigler sense by Facebook or whoever, and that we do need to make statutory or regulatory changes. I would hope that that would be classifiable under the rubric of deregulation, because there's no question that we have had regulatory capture. That's a principal feature in the big government state. So there do have to be statutes that change, right? I'm sure it's been captured. But we also have to remember that the market processes are proceeding. I knew I would be able to use that Fitzgerald term, old crone, after all. I know that the younger generation says that, Facebook's just what my mother is on. And that's not an endorsement of Facebook's future. We're only 19 years into this. We better hurry up and have this panel, because George Gilder wrote a book called Life After Google, saying if this behemoth's revenue model continues to be the thing that people hate, namely advertising that just pops up at them, they're going to be dead as a doornail by 2030. And I'm sure he's correct, and the same thing with Facebook. So, I mean, it's urgent that we have this meeting right now, because we have not given these companies enough time to fail, as IBM had after 1987.
But the reason why you are not on Facebook is probably because you are on Instagram, that is owned by Facebook, and your kids are on WhatsApp, that is owned by Facebook. Right. So I think that we have to be careful, because the natural tendency of these companies is to buy every competitor, and that's where a good antitrust should come in. Because when you're saying IBM sort of was demise, was not demise by the marketplace, was demise actually by the government going after in antitrust cases. The reason why the personal computer revolution took place outside of IBM and was not proprietary of IBM is because when they started the PC, IBM started the PC, they were terrified of the antitrust. And so they started to outsource something in order to make sure that the antitrust was going after that, and that's what brought Microsoft. And the reason why now we have Google and Facebook and not just Microsoft is because the antitrust went after Microsoft in the 1990s. Do you know that the plans of Microsoft was to put a tax on every transaction on the internet? That was their business plan. If we didn't have the antitrust, today we'll have a gigantic monopoly of Microsoft. So I think what maintains vitality of competition is the antitrust. We need to resurrect the antitrust that has fallen asleep at the wheel.
Yeah. These are excellent examples. That's right. The Microsoft antitrust case of the late 1990s, which George Priest wrote so eloquently about at the time, we actually thought, I think Europe still believes today that Microsoft Windows is going to take over the world. That's what we thought in 1998, 1999, and of course that wasn't going to happen at all. Now, I simply ask about causation. We know that Microsoft had to retool and then flourished. Microsoft is another one of these trillion-dollar companies. It's because they changed their business model. Was it necessarily because of the antitrust, or was it because they got real and realized that our product is becoming ossified, and they changed their product. IBM is an interesting case. It's just right there, primed to take care of the internet revolution of the 1990s, and it never happened. And I'm wondering if there isn't some kind of natural upper limit. When companies get really big, they're not going to be the next big thing. I mean, to have a kind of permanent revolution entrepreneurial within a company is very difficult. I think we should watch Google. George Gilder has sounded the clarion. That company's not going to survive the next decade.
Do you want to take a bet? 10 years from now?
Well, I'm speaking for George. He's the betting. He and his friend last night were the betting guys. Yeah.
So this is a great, great conversation. It sounds like there's two ways, and maybe you're both a proponent that it's both, not either or. I don't know. I'd like to hear that. But one is, you need to have the rules of the game that are sorted out so you don't get into this situation. And you mentioned in your opening comments that in the 1970s, most firms didn't have a government department. And now we're saying before they have a fully fleshed out business plan, they have a fully fleshed out lobbying plan. So they're responding to the incentives that they face. On the other side, we're hearing this kind of argument. What I'm hearing is a creative destruction. Technology moves very fast, and so we want to inject that mechanism of profit and loss into the disciplinary function of markets. So do you think, either of you or both of you I'd like to hear from, are both of those the solution? And how do you maintain the government as the overseer of the rules of the game, but also allowing the forces of creative destruction to inject the discipline that we need?
So I think that if you have an infinite faith that this will never happen, then you don't have any problem. This is the idea that the market will always necessarily fix the problem. If that becomes religion, so it's not a conversation. Now, there are a lot of examples, starting with AT&T, until it was broken up in 1984, was a terrible, inefficient firm, and nothing was going on. We broke it up. The antitrust broke it up, and we had the telecommunication revolution. So I think that I agree that it doesn't satisfy the standard of causality and identification that modern economics requires. But if you have to take a bet, I would take a bet that we need to have some concern about excessive concentration of political power. Now, the big question is how you go about doing it. And I am a believer that actually democracy is the best compensation for this. And there is a very talented researcher at the University of Southern California, John Matsusaka, who is writing a book about direct democracy. Direct democracy is not particularly popular these days, especially after the Brexit referendum, but I think that he shows with data that it's sometimes a good way to offset the excessive power of vested interests. And in my book, A Capitalist for the People, I try to give direction of how you set up a system that minimizes the risk of capture. And one very simple idea is that you have to have simple rules at the cost of being economically inefficient. Now, this costs me a lot because as an economist, I'm trained to do the most clever rule and the most efficient rule. But as economists, we completely ignore the cost of enforcing and the cost of lobbying and overturning the rules. So what I'm saying is the beauty of simple rules is that they can be understood by a large fraction of people. And as a result, and it can be monitored by a large fraction of people. And so it's more difficult for the lobbyists to overturn them. The moment I go sophisticated, then I lose the interest of the majority of people. When we talk about details of the accounting regulation, I put everybody to sleep. And that's the time where the lobbyists win. So I think that we need to expose the problem and also simplify the problem so that we have little regulation, but that regulation well enforced and well understood by people.
Brian?
Yeah, let me second that. If we are to have regulation at all, it must be spare. And there's way too much lobbying. There's no question about that. When you have a $5 trillion government, there's going to be a lot of lobbying, and there are going to be a lot of companies that are corrupted by that, probably the biggest companies. That's a natural process of having a $5 trillion government. But if there is progress on that score, we should expect the problem to take on a different hue. We wouldn't say that there's regulatory capture because there's nothing to capture. I'll say one thing about Instagram that's an interesting point. Facebook displayed an early stage big growth company in its purchase of Instagram because it bought it very cheaply, I believe under $1 billion. And everyone says they way underpaid for Instagram. That rarely happens later on when a firm is big and says we still have to be a growth firm. They start to overpay, General Electric being the poster child of this problem today. Hey, we're supposed to be growing like a Jack Welch firm. Let's buy this French power generation manufacturer. And they overpaid such that it bankrupted them. So that's the natural process of a late-stage growth company. They end up having to overpay for things. And this has been demonstrated many times in American business. I think 19 years isn't enough to hang these FANG stocks.
Okay. You know, first of all, they overpay with equity. So the losers are us that have our retirement funds in the S&P 500 and earn a lower return. So there is no sense in which if they were buying with debt, there would be a possibility of bankruptcy that will discipline the companies. But buying with equity is not the case. And so if you're saying that eventually in the centuries, we're all dead, even the Medici family after 300 years or 400 years went into demise, I'm not ready to wait that long. I don't know about you.
Now, the Medici point is very interesting because Italy was generally prosperous through the rise of the Medicis and then began its long sunset. Right, so that is the risk we run, that if we do have big government and if it is captured by the big firms, we are going to experience long-term stagnation, and that won't be good. So we have to make sure we have small government and free firms that are doing great things.
Great. Well, now we'd like to open this up to audience Q&A. So if you have a question, please come to the microphone.
Still too high for me. So thank you for the speech. I enjoyed it. I have a question for the whole panel, so anyone is welcome to jump in. So my broad approach to this topic, economic freedom, is that I think economic freedom is not the end, it's the means to political freedom. And that's why I'm really worried about this concentration of power in those big tech companies. Because nowadays I see them, they're really endangering this market of ideas. I see lots of censorship on Facebook and Twitter and Google. And they are really censoring conservative voices. And that's my biggest worry. And so how to combat this this concentration of power in big tech companies? Obviously, there are two approaches, broad approaches. One is regulation, and the other is promoting competition. But I think either approach, there is a big problem that are confronting the both approaches, which is that we need to sort out the ownership of big data, because I see big data is really the life cord of those big companies, big tech companies. So I'm just wondering whether you have any thoughts on this regard, this ownership of big data. Who do they belong to? So, yeah, thank you.
I think that, as I said, these are extremely complicated topics because they pose new challenges, and a complete answer will hopefully will be given at the conference. Let me give you a short answer. I think that, number one, we understand that the traditional transaction in which you go on your Facebook and they say you are giving up your life here, basically, if you want to register, is not a very fair market transaction because people don't understand what they're giving up and companies take advantage of this, number one. Number two is I cannot even, in a current system, own my own data. And it says if I want to transfer all the information that Facebook has to somebody else because I want to go to a new social media platform to favor competition, I cannot do that. So I think that favoring that transfer is an idea to promote competition. And the United European Union has sort of started in this direction with the so-called Open Banking Directive. So the idea is that if you shop at Citibank, but you want to move to Bank of America, you can ask in a second Bank of America to transfer, or Citibank to transfer all your transaction data to Bank of America. Why this is important is because if Bank of America wants to open a credit card or decide to make you a loan, wants to see your transaction history. So Citibank has a monopoly, local monopoly, on the ability to lend you because of this transaction history. But this history belongs to you, and you can share, and you should be able to share it right away. Third point, and then I stop. I think it's extremely important these days to define what is the instrument you use on internet to identify yourself, the so-called identity. So whenever you approach anything, they say, oh, why don't you log in with Google or log in with Facebook? Because we're sick and tired of putting in our information 500 times a day. However, the moment you log in with Google or Facebook, automatically all the data that you sort of create in that other domain are transferred to Facebook and Google. So they use that identity shortcut to get more data very cheaply. If we had a third party that provides identity, we could actually minimize the information that we share, because some of the time we don't need to share all that information. So imagine I have a digital identity. Whenever I buy liquor online, I don't need to reveal when I'm bored. I just need to reveal that I'm above 21. So if we have a system that minimizes the amount of data we share, we also minimize the concentration you're worried about.
Yeah, I think the big data is a forbidding problem, although the blockchain innovations may really reduce it in the near future. What I'm worried about with big data is that it may cause the big companies to be asked to throw in the briar patch. Oh, government, well, we need to be regulated. Because we have all this big data, you agree with that, and so we will be named the people who can get the data. And that is a classic way that corporate businesses capture the government. So if we go down the road of breaking up these companies or regulating them, they're going to become the Pacific Gas and Electric of the internet.
I think you're absolutely right. This risk is alive and well, and that's the reason why, as conservative, we should actually fight that battle and not fight the battle of not having any regulation. Because if we fight the battle of saying we should not regulate at all big data, eventually it's going to be regulated, and it's going to be regulated exactly in the way you describe. So we should say, no, wait a second, we're not against regulation in principle. This is a very delicate topic that brings not just economics, brings privacy, brings freedom, brings things that are very, very important. So we should fight for a pro-market, pro-freedom regulation that is certainly not the one that Google and Facebook want.
Next question.
Luke Foster from the University of Chicago. Thank you very much for the panel, and I particularly found it very heartening in a way to hear a positive case for the state's role in these questions. But the worry I have has to do with knowledge asymmetries, with the capacity of government bureaucracy to actually do this work. It came up in the course of your remarks that the U.S. has a tradition of our best and brightest people going to the private sector, and public sector work is actually tacitly and openly discouraged and looked down upon. Of course, in continental Europe, it's rather different. The civil service tradition has very high prestige, and so arguably bureaucracies might be a little more competent. But there's still this worry that the people who know enough are expert enough in the technological infrastructure to regulate these companies effectively are precisely those people coming from that industry, which reinforces the lobbying problem. So, like, really touched on broader questions of technocracy and the regime type, but how do we actually ensure that our bureaucracy is competent enough to deal with these challenges?
Do you want to start?
Or is that impossible?
Yeah, I think in general, the most important thing is that government shrinks. Because if, let's just as a proxy, let's say we have a $5 trillion government. Let's have a $2.5 trillion government. Cut it in half. Then all of a sudden, less of it can be captured. And it also, conversely, becomes more dignified to work for government because it's not as big anymore. It's not as kind of disgusting. So I think there's just a kind of virtuous circle that begins to take hold whenever you shrink government, and that could be the beginning of the solution.
I actually disagree because if I want to have law and order, the solution is not to shrink the police and pay them less. Since we see in Chicago what happened, it doesn't work. So if you want to have law and order, you want to have good police department and pay them relatively well. Now, is that a danger that they become Maduro with, yes, there is that danger. However, I think in modern democracies, we, especially advanced democracies like the United States, I think we overcame that risk, okay? And I hope I'm not wrong in saying that we don't fear a coup d'etat of the police or the army in the United States. And you know, this is not a foregone conclusion. And it says we give this for granted, but in most places in the world, that's the first worry you have to worry about. So I think that there is the risk of one part of the government becoming too powerful, and the police and the army is clearly an example. There is a risk of that part of the government to become too little powerful and too little competent. So I'm definitely in the case of limited government, but the stuff that the government does should do it well and not be incompetent. And also being more transparent in revolving doors and financing and all the stuff that makes the regulator particularly captured. In a sense, the amount of capture that we have of regulators today is unbelievable. The EPA has draft of regulation written by the chemical companies that it's supposed to regulate. So I think that that is a serious problem. I don't think that the solution is to have zero environmental regulation, because we know that there are externalities and we need to deal with that. So I think we need to limit what the government does, but what it does do should do it well with competent people and actually pay decently well.
Hi, I'm Jacob Richards from Arizona. I've got a similar question. Given the political connectedness of these companies that we're discussing potentially regulating, and given the presence of their lobbyists in D.C., what would it look like to try to introduce regulation that they would likely be opposed to? Is that a realistic goal, to think that these corporations are so well connected in D.C. that they are capturing our regulatory apparatus, so we need to introduce new regulation that somehow is going to escape the influence of their lobbyists? Is that a realistic goal to say, given the presence of their lobbying and the way that they've been using the regulatory regime, we're going to increase regulation in a way that they're not going to be able to push back against? And what would that look like in terms of how do you go from their influence over our current regulatory regime to, you know, developing the political capital to push back against that?
Start.
I think one of the major developments since Reagan in Washington has been the way big companies have explored regulation more than exceptions from the tax code. Because with the serial reduction in the marginal income tax rates, loopholes and exemptions have become less and less profitable. And so there was a natural migration on the part of cronies towards looking into the regulatory apparatus. What I would do is just finish the job. I mean, take the tax rates lower. Take the corporate rate zero, there's no exemptions to it. All of a sudden, that just destroys the tons of cronyist business models. The regulatory apparatus is much more amorphous, and I think that's why crony business likes it. It's more difficult to wrestle down compared to what happened to the tax code. And so that's a more difficult problem.
I think it's... what you're suggesting, in my view, is dangerous, because I think that regulation will take place. Why? Because in a democracy, people eventually figure it out and want an intervention. And so I think that our role should be to make sure that the intervention taken the right way and not in the wrong way. And let me give you an example. I think that many aspects of today's economy resemble the end of the 19th century, beginning of the 20th century, where political contributions were even bigger than today, where McKinley was basically considered owned by the largest firms, where the Senate was considered a chamber of butler for industrialist interest, and so on and so forth. That things change. Why change? Because there was a lot of political resentment, but also there was a president like Theodore Roosevelt that got there by luck, but still, there was a president that understood the importance of channeling that kind of grassroots movements, not rejected, but channeled into some reforms that actually improve the market system. And I think my view is what we need today is we need a figure like Theodore Roosevelt, not somebody that wants to destroy the business or to punish the business, like we see too many people today campaigning, but somebody that wants to promote a fair, competitive market system.
Hi, I'm Ben Barr. I'm a partner with Statecraft in Washington, D.C. Two-part question regarding social media giants. I think it's tempting to view them as Goliaths, and many reform attempts seem aimed at weakening or subtracting or dividing them in some way. But I think about, you know, empowering Davids. That is, there's a lack of a property ownership in the data that individuals own in the United States, and that creates confusion and some of the calamity that we see today. So I'm wondering if either of the commentators support a model property rights approach to this, some possessory interest in your own personal data, which leads to the second question. The European Union, who's usually sluggish in most regards, has its GDPR, the General Data Protection Rights Regulation. And half of it's aimed, I think, in the wrong direction, that is dividing sort of social media. But the other is it sort of stumbled, I think, in the right direction of personal ownership over data. So I wonder what your views or criticism of that might be.
I think that I like the idea of a property rights of data to promote competition. That is the idea that I promoted with an article in the New York Times of portability of the social graph goes exactly in that direction. I like some of the stuff of the GDPR. The problem is, like all regulation, is that has a lot of entry cost. And so what I hear is that at this point, and this is very much to his line, Google and Facebook love the GDPR because if I am a new startup, that regulation is very costly for me, and so I find it difficult to deal with. But if I am Facebook and Google, it's a piece of cake. So what we have to be careful, and I think should be a mandate for every regulation, is that regulation is not impeding or disproportionately costly new entry. And I think that having some form of size-based regulation, so that if I'm small, not that I can do whatever I think, but almost, and only when I reach a certain level, then I have to have bigger standards. That is the kind of regulation I would like. It's clearly not the regulation that Facebook and Google want.
Yeah, that's a real nest, property law. Copyright law was much looser in the 19th century than it was in the 20th century on the grounds that if you possess something, you own it. I mean, if you possess a poem, you can use it for whatever reason you want to. You don't have to appeal to the literary executor. That's a real nest. I think we have some lessons to learn from the 19th century.
All right. Thank you. Please join me in thanking our panelists for a great hour. Thank you, guys.